Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Institute of Leadership and Management's weekly news roundup podcast, where we take a critical look at a number of topical developments from the past few days with a leadership and management theme. I am Rod Jones, Content Manager at the Institute, and in this podcast, we will be looking at news up to the 13th of January 2020. Joining me to analyse these stories is Kate Cooper, Head of Research, Policy and Standards at the Institute. Hello, Kate.
Hello, Rod.
Our first story, Kate, is that 2/5 of business managers are reluctant to hire people who require flexible working. This is a survey commissioned by knowyourmoney.co.uk. The online comparison website commissioned a study amongst more than 2,000 UK adults, all of whom work full-time in UK organisations, and 750 of which work at management or director level. The survey found that 41% of managers do not believe employees perform their jobs as effectively when they work remotely, and almost half of managers feel that they have to regularly check in on employees not working in the office to ensure that they are productive. Kate, what more can be done to ensure leaders fully understand the benefits of flexible working for their organisations and for the employees themselves?
Well, my first reaction to this is it's more about the managers than the people that they're working, that they feel they can't trust them to work unless they are in full sight, as it were. And does that say something about how they select people, or do they create an environment where people feel that they only need to work if they're being watched? It makes me think of the old McGregor's theory X and theory Y. You essentially get what it is you expect. And if you expect people to slack when they're not being watched, then perhaps that's exactly what they'll do. So I think they have to think about their management style and actually say to these people, what can we do to ensure that you are your most productive even while working flexibly or when working flexibly? Because the answer isn't to stop flexible working. I think that's not going to happen. This really contradicts a story that we read in study finds about people who can't stop working. So those managers who are concerned about people underperforming when they're working flexibly might think about the opportunities it gives people to not exactly overperform, but certainly work far longer hours than is probably good for them.
Thank you very much, Kate. Our next story is taken from an article in The Guardian that suggests, forget the nanny state, here comes the nanny employer. This article suggests that employee wellness programmes are encouraged by the UK government as it looks to shift the burden of healthcare from the NHS. The article goes on to say that corporate wellness programmes are particularly common in the US because most people get health insurance through their employer, and a healthy workforce means lower premiums. However, they are becoming more widespread in Britain and are being actively encouraged by a government that seems keen on shifting the burden of healthcare from the NHS to employers. For example, a 2018 UK government green paper called for jobs that actively support and nurture health and well-being and praised the likes of Barclays for its internal mental health programme. And last year, Boris Johnson proposed tax incentives to companies that support their employees' mental health. Kate, how do leaders draw the line between being helpful and being intrusive?
It's interesting, isn't it? When there's a strong business case for something, it tends to happen, as we've seen with the experience in the States. It's also difficult to argue against anything that's designed to improve the health and well-being of employees. And I think it's a recognition that you bring your whole self to work, and you can't do your best work if you're physically under par, suffering from mental health issues, and your employer should share that responsibility. But can it go a step too far with people being measured on what they eat or what they consume and then facing disciplinary processes as a result of that? It's really, isn't it? It's managing that line well so the employee is confident that it's their interests that at the heart of such initiatives, and it's not just about the bottom line.
Thank you, Kate. Our next story looks at the widely publicised apology by a Nobel Prize winner after she retracted a paper published in the journal Science in May 2019. The Guardian reported that in a remarkable display of humility, Dr. Frances Arnold, who won the Nobel Prize in Chemistry in 2018, came forward herself to let her followers know that a 2019 paper of hers had been retracted. Dr. Dr. Arnold tweeted, "It is painful to admit, but important to do so. I apologise to all. I was a bit busy when this was submitted and did not do my job well." The response to this tweet was overwhelmingly positive, with Dr. Arnold receiving widespread praise for taking responsibility and not looking for someone else to blame. Kate, what can leaders take from Dr. Arnold's display of humility?
This is a really good example of taking responsibility for a mistake and doing something about it quickly. And we've talked before about cultures of learning, and you learn from your mistakes, undoubtedly. So if this was or has been encouraging to the people who work with Dr. Arnold, that it's okay to get it wrong, I think the important message is to own that mistake and for your colleagues to allow you to move on. Because if you don't make mistakes, you're not really going to learn.
Thank you very much, Kate. Our next story asks, should CEOs abandon the corner office and sit amongst their staff? Is the whole notion of CEOs being tucked away in their own quarter surrounded by creature comforts somewhat behind the times? If MSC software chief Paolo Guglielmini is anything to go by, that seems to be the case. In an 8th of January interview with BBC News thread CEO Secrets, he says that he prefers to do hot desk amongst his people rather than have his own dedicated office space. His firm, which designs simulation software for industrial tests, has 1,000 staff around the world, and no matter which branch of the company he visits, he always sits at a small desk in the same part of the office where his employees sit, within easy reach. Kate, should these sorts of arrangements be determined by organisations' business models, or do they simply constitute a better, more available form of leadership?
I think it takes a real confidence to sit amongst your staff like this on a frequent, anyone can do it as a sort of one-off guest appearance, because it conveys so much about you as a manager, as a communicator. And if you are role modelling open communication, transparency, people in the organisation see how you deal with customers, see how you deal with colleagues, see how you deal with suppliers. And that really sets the tone for the office. Similarly, of course, if you're role modelling bad habits, they too will be picked up. The issue really, when we talk about the business model, is about confidentiality. How much are you able to share? I'm thinking particularly perhaps in financial services, in advice firms, where if people are giving advice, it does have to be of a much more private nature. But that very openness and confidence in your own management style, absolutely to be encouraged.
Thank you very much, Kate. Our next story asks, what can the UK learn from a US city about helping veterans into new careers? Fascinating insights into efforts to jumpstart the post-service careers of US military veterans have emerged from a recent article at Inc.com. And in the piece, managing editor Lindsay Blakely presents a case study of Colorado Springs, where 17% of the workforce is ex-military. Brewer Todd Baldwin, who from the age of 24 served for 16 months as an artillery officer in Iraq, tells Blakely that in just 48 months, the city's commercial landscape has done a 180 from consisting only of chain restaurants, big brand stores and Department of Defense contractors to having a thriving startup culture. Meanwhile, Baldwin's brewery, Red Leg, has become a hothouse of mentorship for struggling veterans with business ambitions who regularly drop by the firm's tasting room for advice and networking events. Kate, what can the UK learn from Colorado Springs, firstly, about the initiative and capabilities of veterans, and secondly, the sort of ecosystem that must exist around them to provide advice, reassurance, and access to opportunities?
Well, I think there's no doubt about the wealth of skills and capabilities that veterans bring with them after serving and can certainly transfer into the organisation. And our own research would support that. Creating an ecosystem where they're able to learn from each other as well as more established businesses. And then, of course, they become the experts and they pass on their advice and expertise. So the real challenge for Colorado Springs and any sort of similar arrangement in the UK is keeping people in those places so that they don't immediately move on. And I think that has to be a flexibility of size. It has to enable organisations to grow and to work very hard at keeping that community and that communication open. And it's not easy. And I think in a way, some of it will happen organically, but also some of it has to be orchestrated. As we see, certainly in the UK, the demise of high streets, there must be things that people can do. And I'm thinking particularly at the moment of Debenhams to keep those communities alive. And as we see here, it doesn't have to be just coffee mornings and general social events. It can be worthwhile economic activity that could be supported in this way.
Thank you very much, Kate. And that concludes this week's episode. Listeners can find further topical content in the News and Views section on the Institute's website at www.institutelm.com. And thank you once again, Kate, for your insights on these stories.
Thank you, Rod.